The format of tonight's meeting is 2 10-minute speakers, the first of which will speak on the third tradition, followed by our information break, and then our main speaker who will speak for 30 minutes. Our first 10-minute speaker to share on the third tradition is Christine.
Hello, my name's Christine and I'm an alcoholic. Hi, it's really great to be here. Always wonderful to share my experience on any topic, in any meeting, any AA meeting, obviously. And I want to thank Randy for asking me to speak. And I will read the long form, but I want to welcome the newcomer before I do that. Want to welcome anyone that's new tonight or anyone that's coming back. And I won't make any assumptions that you're going to be bored by my tradition talk, because when I was new, I was never bored. I was always, you know, angsty and trying to fix my problems, which I had a lot of. And I was told that, you know, I could leave my problems at the door and just for 1 hour focus on my recovery, and whatever the talk was about, just try to be an investigator to see where I identified. And if I didn't identify, you know, not to judge it, just chuck it. Just leave it. And that really helped me, so I wanted to pass that on. And I also want to tell you quickly why I drank. I'll borrow an analogy because it really helped me. Before I drank, I felt like a duck, but like an ugly duck. And maybe not right away, but early on in my drinking, when I drank, it transformed me into a beautiful golden eagle, and I could like fly around and like do things. I was graceful and I was able to like accomplish things that I never could. And then somewhere down the road, I ended up, crossing some invisible line. I don't know when. And then all I could do was think about drinking. And then when I started drinking, all I could do was drink. And it was a Groundhog's Day kind of life. It nearly killed me. And, you know, I ended up crawling. Well, I mean, I walked, but I crawled into AA, like, spiritually. And I'm so grateful that when I did, that nobody handed me a form to fill out or asked me, like, how the quantity of my drinking last week or whether or not I was even an alcoholic. Because if that had happened, I would have said 3, no, and goodbye. I would have absolutely left. I know how to answer those questions well. But I remember... I remember just being asked, you know, how are you, do you work around here? I'm glad you're here. Those kinds of things. And that was the group practicing the third tradition. I'm really grateful for that. It helped me to have my own experience, and, I wouldn't be sober without the third tradition, definitely. I love how Billy N talks about the traditions and that, they're the antidote to 12 of the biggest mistakes that AA has made in history. And, you know, the third tradition and what happened there is no different. We made some massive, massive mistakes. You know, in the early adolescence, AA was, just getting off the ground. Groups were springing up all over the place and people were kind of assembling their lives. They were cleaning up. They were looking good. And they decided it was a good idea maybe to have, membership rules. So they were screening people when they were coming in. And, you know, if you were, in the book it talks about a crackpot or a promiscuous woman or, you know, a drug addict or anything that kind of wasn't fitting in with what they thought the reputation of the group should be, you could not come. And, this was, detrimental. Who knows how many lives we lost, you know, during that period. And, In the 12 and 12, it talks about finally coming to a conclusion where, you know, they ask themselves, like, what would the master do? And to me, that's like a real drop the mic kind of question, you know, boom, like, well, you know, what would the master do? And, alcoholism doesn't have any prejudice. It really doesn't care if you're a single mommy or if you're a newlywed or if you're homeless and you can't handle another blow. It doesn't care. And in order to combat that, we need to have something that is broad and roomy and is all inclusive and not exclusive. It's the only thing that we can, that's really going to balance that. And that's what happened. Bill said something like, who are we considering our own past to deny any man or woman this opportunity? And so the third tradition took a while for the groups to embrace that, but when it did, it swung the doors wide open, and they've stayed open ever since, thank God. So the third tradition, being, you know, the only requirement for membership is a desire to stop drinking, in the short form, allows anybody who's here to be here. It doesn't matter what weird, icky things you've done in your past, or what your background is, or what's in your bank account, what you're wearing. There's no dress code to AA. You can be here because, and if you say that you're a member, you are. So now I'm going to read the long form. I'm so grateful that I got to look at this again because it's distinctively different from, well, it does have differences from the short form. So our membership ought to include all who suffer from alcoholism. Hence, we may refuse none who wish to recover. Nor ought AA membership ever depend upon money or conformity. Any two or three alcoholics gathered for sobriety may call themselves an AA group, provided that, as a group, they have no other affiliation. And my experience is that, you know, in the throes of my alcoholism, maybe not a lot of times, but there are definitely a handful of times that I had such a sincere, honest desire to stop drinking. You know, the next day, I found myself like, how could it have happened again? Or, you know, I just was so over the pain. I was so over the humiliation. I was so over, like, losing the best years in my life. And, you know, I know now that on my own, I didn't have the power to do it. Because which is what it says in the long form, I suffer from alcoholism. And I suffer from, you know, an illness that attacks my body, my mind, and my spirit. For me, alcohol is the solution. So it's not just, I'm really grateful that nobody made me fill out any financial statements when I came in. And, you know, I'm allowed to be here. But it's really my responsibility to, if I want long-term sobriety, to do the work in the steps. And that's where I've gotten my recovery. What else do we have? I also have to, you know, I've got a couple 24. Oh, I've always wanted to say that. I have a couple 24. And I have a responsibility now as a member. I've been here a little bit. I've gone through the steps a couple times, and now I have a responsibility, and there are things that I need to check myself on. Like, for example, when I come into a meeting, do I make a beeline for my girlfriends so I can tell them about, you know, something awesome that happened to me or something bad that happened to me, or do I look around to see a face that I've never met before to make somebody feel welcome? You know, am I starstruck when I see a famous person? Do I treat them differently? Do I give them more attention than I would somebody else? But these are things that I need to look at. The other thing that I used to be much better at it, but I used to have this amazing gift where I could tell whether or not I would like you by just looking at you, or I just kind of knew your story by seeing you, and then, you know, that tell whether or not I would, like, continue a conversation. So am I doing that when I see a newcomer? Do I see somebody and go, I know her story. There's no way she's going to stay sober. No way. Thank you. You know, I remember being so judgmental when I had like a year and I was totally recovered from alcoholism and, you know, it was just like spiritual. And there were people that I judged. And I'm going to tell you today, you know, almost 9 years later, I never thought they would stay sober. They're thriving. They're thriving in their lives. We don't know. That's why we have, you know, this tradition is here to protect you from me. And I'm so grateful for that. And you're so grateful for that. Thanks for listening.
Our second 10-minute speaker is George.
Hello, my name is George. I'm an alcoholic. I'm sitting over here and I was thinking to myself the first time I walked in this room, this was my first real meeting where I really wanted to try this thing. And I felt like I didn't belong here and I didn't understand why I was here and nothing felt right. None of my thoughts made any sense. And I just walked in because somebody told me and I was that desperate. I'll get back to that in a second. This is my home group, AG. My sobriety date is October 20th, 2016. I have a sponsor. My sponsor has a sponsor. And I work the steps, and I go to meetings every day still. I meet with my sponsor as much as possible, and I'm on step 9, living at 10 and 11. There's no cure, really. All we have is today. I mean, I'm sitting over here thinking I still don't belong. They're going to expose me. Everybody's going to figure it out, and it's, you know, it's going to just, here we go. But that's, I've learned that that's my ego. I call it my ego. That it's going to use my fear. It's going to use my success. It's going to use anything it can to make itself relevant. To keep me away from God or keep that channel blocked. Okay, let me just keep this simple. I am speaking to the person that, whether you just got out of rehab or you've been to an AA meeting 10 years ago because of a DWI and your girlfriend just left you or somebody gave you an ultimatum, whatever your thing is, you're here. I'm speaking to you. Whether you think you belong or you don't, you're here and you're here for a reason. Hopefully something I say can help you. So I'm just going to tell you a little bit about myself and my personal experience. And my first drink, my dad's off the boat from Greece, so I drank it at my grandparents' farm in like the mountains. And it was gross. It was like cognac. They needed to mix some water in it, but they liked it really strong. It burned. And I didn't want it, but after probably the second or third summer, and I was 11 years old, so by the time I was 13, they kept that bottle away from me. And we'd still drink the bottle, but they had a huge barrel that was like a 2-year supply right in the kitchen. Why were they holding the bottle away from me, and why didn't they just refill it? And I realized I have this fear thing, so I've learned about this. I mean, this is all looking back. At the time, I had no idea what's going on inside of me. I'm starting to make a little bit of sense. Not totally there yet. But fear is losing something that you have or not getting something you want. And I felt that fear. If that's fear, that's what I felt. When I was feeling good, I felt fear because something was going to happen that was going to take that good feeling away. And when I wasn't feeling good, I wanted to feel good. And I was afraid that I wasn't going to feel good. And if I felt bad, I thought I was feeling bad for the rest of my life. And that's how I was born, and that's how I die, and that would be it. So I guess I go from one extreme to the other. When I got back from Greece, I started taking little swigs of liquor from my friend's cabinets, my friend's parents, and it was cool because we're doing something we're not supposed to do and we're doing it together, and that stuck with me too. It was like a part of, you know, like a part of my family in Greece that couldn't speak English, or a part of some sort of friendship or brotherhood with the guys that I was drinking with. And those feelings, they made it that I wanted to be a drinker. I definitely, you know, wasn't like an athlete or wasn't the smartest kid, but I was happy to form that identity and say I'm a drinker. And the first chance I had to use something in my life as an excuse to say, wow, you know, I'm going to just really throw myself into this, I did. But it was always there. I was just waiting for it. And I just didn't have an on switch. I mean, I drank with people that drank a lot, and they drank like I did, except for some reason, at some point, they could turn it off, and I just never could. When everybody else was passing out, I was just getting started. And it doesn't mean that I have, like, the highest tolerance or anything. I mean, I could be laying on the floor puking and thinking, we're just getting started. So, you know, it was not always reality. Fact is, look, I know that I belong here because I'm an alcoholic. I've been arrested, facing felony charges, couldn't stay sober. I've had people tell me they're going to leave me, I'm going to lose my home, my relationship, my loved ones, my college education, my life, my driver's license, my freedom. Nothing was enough to stop me from drinking. I thought it was, but then, wait a second, what's this in my hand? Oh, I'm drinking again. Well, okay. It got to the point where I just embraced the nightmare, and I'm like, I guess all these, I got tired of making promises I couldn't keep, you know? Forget the job, forget the relationship, forget everything. I'm turning my phone off. I'm not going to, like, manage the girlfriend and the career and the family, keep them separate. And after 20 years of doing that, I just got tired of it. Turn my phone off and party. And I'd spend all my money. And I was just obsessed with drinking and alcohol. And I'd always end up in the same place, like under a bridge with a couple homeless guys. Like, we're drinking out of the same, you know. And there was no, like, wild party, and it wasn't that fun. But I could not stop. And thankfully, I was intervened on. People started comparing notes. They realized that, you know, everything out of my mouth is a lie. And I knew that, but then even, like, the things that I thought were true were also lies. So that was kind of interesting. I'm still figuring that out a little bit. What else? So I went to rehab. I was going to do a 30-day cleanse. Yeah, because that's it. Just like, you know, like, I always wanted to, like, drink, like, you know, one of those drinks and cleanse myself. So I was like, perfect. And then I'll be able to drink normally, because I was at meetings when I was 25, and I didn't get sober until I'm 35. So I didn't get it. I didn't get the message. I didn't get the step work. I didn't get God. None of that. It didn't make sense to me. And, you know, even if I thought I was willing, I was just lying to myself, right? So, because it's myself. It's my ego. Again, there it is, just telling me lies. And I'm not the guy that is the voice in my head. I'm the guy that has to listen to the voice in my head. You know, and that's not original. I've heard that before from someone else, so I'm just repeating it. But we're not what we think. You know, you're not what you feel. You're just what you do. And I'm learning that, you know, now I'm a guy that can show up. However, went to rehab. It hasn't been smooth sailing since then. Okay. That was back in April. I walked through these doors May 10th. They brought the AA meetings into rehab in Vegas, and a speaker there said to me, I said to him, I said, I'm going back to New York. And after the first couple of days of that cleanse, I realized anxiety is not thinking about the bad things that you've done. It's like your body is shaking and you're not getting the reward that you've conditioned yourself to have. And that's when I realized this is real, and I'm really trying to kill myself, and I'm doing a great job. So, whoa. See what I mean? Anyway, how much time do I have left? 1 minute. Oh, my God. Well, I have a bunch of sober brothers. I follow all the steps. My life is so much better now. Honestly, like, I couldn't believe that this stuff is happening. I have hope. I cannot understand that word, but I live it. I try and keep the channel clear between me and God, because he speaks to me. He speaks through me. I don't have it all figured out. But getting honest with my sponsor was the most important thing for me. Because when I was lying to my sponsor and I had little secrets, even though I was gangster with the meetings and gangster with the fellowship and doing all the things, step work, oh, I shared. Everything was so powerful. And I could have passed the polygraph on it, and I thought I was being so honest, but I was not even knowing that I'm lying. These little secrets were killing me. Because when I got on my knees and I pray to God, He knows and I know that I'm still trying to make a deal. Still trying to negotiate and then renegotiate and then denegotiate. And that's the, you know, He knows it and I know it. And as soon as I got honest with my sponsor, I was able to start getting honest with myself, and God showed up, and everything has not been perfect. Life is happening every day, but I show up. I got a baby now, 3 weeks old. I'm holding him, showing up for my family, showing up for AG, showing up for myself. Guys are awesome. Yo, this AA saved my life. Talk to me after the meeting if you just got out of rehab.
Hey guys, I'm Tim and I'm an alcoholic. Whew, I'm so grateful to be here. I got to tell you something. To be asked to speak for 30 minutes at the Atlantic Group is like, the Super Bowl of AA to me. I really is. I'm just so honored to be here. And I know a lot of you guys. I have a lot of really good friends here and I want to recognize them. But I'm grateful. And it's for all you counting days, this is all about you. And I want to talk about why I'm able to stand up here, how I got freedom from my obsession to drink alcohol. But before I do that, I want to thank Randy for inviting me to speak. I've been waiting a long time to get asked to speak up here. I want to thank Christine for the third tradition. She did a great job. You did a great job. You know, the only requirement for membership is a desire to stop drinking. How great is that? And there's a lot of history to that. If you're new, the only thing you got to remember is you're welcome here. If you've been around, you should look at the history of how that tradition came to play. There was a guy named Barry L. who wrote Living Sober, who was involved early on in the conference. And he tells stories of how Bill Wilson was consulted about allowing gays and lesbians into the fellowship all the way back in the late 30s. Deviants, that's what we were called. You know, I mean, sometimes we are deviants, but but that's what we were called then. And they called the shot way back then that everybody's allowed here. So if you feel like you're different, you're probably in the right place. And we're all able to be here. And it is the only requirement. Now, you said we don't have a dress code. Well, you do if you speak for the Atlanta Group. So it doesn't apply to everything, but I'm very happy to have this on. And great job, George. I didn't know. I think maybe I have to do sign language if I didn't, you know. He has the moves. I love it. I heard the message, and you spoke to the newcomer, which is really important. And that's why we're here. It's all about the newcomer. When I first heard about AG, I wasn't sober yet. It was a while ago. My sobriety date is August 9, 2001. But I struggled for several years, and I heard about it, the Atlantic Group. I heard that there was great sobriety, and the women were really good-looking. The fact that I wasn't chasing women, I don't know, it escaped me. But I have to tell you today, I do come here for the women. And I come here for somebody like Peggy, who is simply amazing. And I came here when I had, 9 months. And Ava, who I'll talk about in a second, introduced me to Peggy. And Peggy looked at me, and she said, "Your death has been interrupted." I thought, who the hell is she? I'm scared. But I'm so glad my death's been interrupted. Also, Ava, she's my very best sober friend. I have a sponsor. His name's John. I have two sponsors named John, so I just say I have a sponsor named John. One knows he's my sponsor. One doesn't know he's my sponsor. It works out like that. I tried to get a hold of both of them today. Of course, I hadn't called them in a while, but I was speaking. So I wanted to say I tried to reach my sponsor. I sponsor people, some people in the room. There's a guy who I've sponsored for almost since I've been sober who's in the room. He's here tonight, and it's just a thrill to have that. But Ava is my best sober friend, and everybody should have one because she's honest with me. And when things are tough, if I'm not willing to tell Ava something, I probably shouldn't be doing it. And she saved my life in many ways. And there's other fabulous people, too. I can't go all Bonnie and a lot of people who I love. I was born in Kentucky, a poor white gay boy in Kentucky, and that's enough to drink right there. And the reason I go all the way back is because I suffer from a hopeless state of mind and body, not just the alcoholism. I truly believe that I had the ism before I took the drink. The drink was a solution to my thinking and my problem. And I knew I was different. And I remember being 6 years old and calling a family meeting. We lived in Kentucky. I must have seen something about New York on the television. I had a family meeting, an emergency meeting, because I wanted to know how they expected me to live in Kentucky when there was New York. And that is how I approach my life. There was never enough. And I can tell you, I actually heard it in an Atlantic group meeting. Somebody said it, and I really identify with it, is that I had a really horrible childhood until I was 2 years sober and did my four step. And then I came to realize I was loved and nourished and cherished. And they did the best they could, and they had flaws. But I have to tell you, I was born with such a sense of a hole. You know, I learned my early superpowers, which were people-pleasing, manipulation, self-centeredness. I learned those early on because I could get things from people. And there was never enough love. My mom loved me dearly, but there was never enough. Now, I don't know if that's, I was in, you know, I either needed a drink or a four-step when I was like seven. But since I didn't have the four-step, you know, in Kentucky, we actually give children bourbon. Well, I don't know that everybody does, but, you know, and so that was my first kind of entry in. When I was 14 years old, a freshman in high school, I had a little access to alcohol, but it was the last day of school, and the freshmen give the seniors a dance. And my older brother bought me a six-pack of beer, a couple six-packs of beer. And me and my buddies and our girlfriends, you know, we got together, we drank all the beer, and we went to the freshman dance. Well, I lit up. I mean, it was like I came alive with the alcohol. Somehow I threw my girlfriend off the balcony or the stands. Wasn't a good first sign with women. And, you know, I remember my high school football coach grabbing me and telling me that night that I'm going to call your parents tomorrow and tell them I'm going to call them. And of course I forgot. And at 14 years old, he called the next day. I answered the phone. He asked for my father and he told my parents I was an alcoholic. You know, that he saw in me. Now, I don't know if this guy was in the program. I don't know his story. But he identified early on in me. And so the first thing for me to understand is that when I put alcohol in my body, everything else starts to fade away. I have a physical reaction to it. And early on, I think it helped me. Because as I was starting to deal with my own sex stuff, there was no Will and Grace, there was no role model, there was nothing that I could really identify with. And there was a lot of self-hatred. I came from a very religious family that was doing the best they could. And, you know, I remember my mother saying this, before my mother passed away, I had a great relationship with her. So I say this in what she dealt with. But she said, I'd rather see my child dead at the foot of the cross than commit a mortal sin. And when you tell that to a 14-year-old whose hormones are raging and they have an attraction for somebody else, that's a pretty dramatic thing. And, you know, during high school, I was able to kind of behave and hold it in. But when I got out of high school and I went to college and I got access to alcohol, things really started to change. And I joined a fraternity. My nickname was Ralph because I could throw up and count the alphabet. And I thought it was a skill I could use in life. And I quickly started to spin out of control, and I was 17 years old. I remember when I was 18, I was 18 in October. October 20th is my birthday. You got sober on my birthday. It's all about me. Just remember that, George. I want you to thank me next year. I ask that we get grain alcohol because that's what every good person from Kentucky asked for, with Kool-Aid, so that I could drink until I passed out. And, you know, I got my wish, and that's how I rolled. And I failed out of college my freshman year. I was a bit of a mess. My family had moved to Fort Lauderdale. I moved down there. I went down there and I stopped dating girls and I started dating boys. And let me tell you, when you're paying to take girls out, it's a lot more convenient when the boys are paying to take you out. So I went from low class to highfalutin in a minute. But my actions were not consistent with my principles. And by the time I was 23 years old, I was already, I was hitting a bottom. And I went to my first meeting. But I went into the meeting and I didn't see the people I identified with. I didn't see who I see here tonight. I have to tell you, you guys are beautiful. Really beautiful. I mean, physically, the brightness in the eyes. You know, that's something that when I first came here before I was sober, it scared me. But it's something that attracts me now. You know, I see your eyes awake. I see the work you do when newcomers come in. That's one thing I really love about the Atlantic Group. There's so many people that raise their hand to count days. You're safe here. And if you want to change your life, and I'll spend the second half of my talk talking about that because that's what's more important. I have a different way of life today. I have access to different tools. I have a loving, caring, higher power in my life. You know, I have a lot of these gifts, but it wasn't always that way. And it's not because I'm a bad person, because I think I was always a good person, but I just had a really bad filter. And that lens that I look through, the actions I took, man, bad behavior came out. When I was 24, I met somebody who was not a big drinker and didn't do other stuff that I was doing at the time. He lived in New York. I was living in Florida. And I did what I've heard other people do. I turned my will in my life over to somebody else to control my drinking. You know, there's lots of stories in the big book about the guy that didn't drink for 25 years about, you know, and I could put down some stuff for a little while. I still had a little bit of room. And so I grabbed onto that and I white knuckled it for several years. I moved to New York. My career got better. But I still was left with my thinking and my values and my superpowers. You know, when I used things like people pleasing, I never understood why I was so nice to people and they were always mad at me. Because you would ask me to do something, I would say yes, I would resent you for it, I wouldn't show up, and then you'd be mad at me. You know, it wasn't until somebody helped me with inventory I was able to flip that. And the other thing is, in that relationship, you know, some things that were so that I can see today. I remember having a conversation with him. I'm 25 years old, and I had this, you know, the normal 25-year-old conversation. I said, if I die, would you date somebody else, right? That's the first thing you want to ask somebody after you've been with them a year. And he said, yeah, I'm 26. I probably would. And I was like, you are so self-centered, right? Because that's the only coping mechanism I had. And I had this monogamous relationship, which meant that you didn't know what I did, right? And I have to tell you, I really struggled with relationships. It's pretty unusual, but my husband is here tonight in this room, who is, I don't know if he's seen me speak in one of these in a while, but we've been together longer than it's been legal for me to be. I've been sober longer than it's been legal for me to be married to him, I put it that way. And I'm grateful for that. So, and he's kind of like the alternative fact checker. So, you know, if I give alternative facts, he can verify it after the meeting. Either that or we'll have a fight. I'm not sure. No. But I didn't have the skill sets. I didn't have the skill set, you know, and it wasn't like I didn't mean to be, I meant to be. But I needed backup. I needed to know you were there for me, and in case you're not, and if you're not there for me because you're going to find out I'm flawed, I need backup. How am I doing with the hand signs, George? Not as good as you. And that is hard to live that way. I had ambition with work. I did pretty well, but my ambition was I would be cutthroat to get ahead. I thought expense accounts were part of my salary. And I took graciously from them. Fast forward mid-30s, my relationship fell apart, obviously. The good news is he was worse than me in his behavior, so I could blame him. And then I went through this period of acting out where it was kind of working but not kind of working. So there were some good days, and there were a lot of bad days, and there's a lot of self-hatred. And I'll just share a little bit on that because there were times – did you give me the 15-minute mark? No. There were times when I'd have a house in Fire Island, and I'd be passed out on the walk where people would see my behavior, and they'd say, that's just Tim. You know, we're acceptable, really, the bar lowered. I was waking up with people that I hadn't been introduced to, you know. I was doing things that I was afraid of doing. I also lived through the whole AIDS thing in the 80s. The idea of protecting myself or then protecting somebody else was secondary to my desire to do what I wanted to do. I didn't want to cramp my style. And it was pulling me apart. And I don't have, you know, I'm actually on the program committee for a sober event this summer. Thank you. And I'm listening to a lot of speaker tapes. And I always feel like I don't have I have story envy. Like, you know, I listen to speaker tapes and this person they died twice and they'd broken all their bones and then they were run over by a car and, you know, and you hear these stories. I don't have that story, but I guarantee I feel as victimized in my story as any of them. And I feel as pained and as hurt, you know, and maybe I'm just more selfish. So in 1998, when I realized I needed to go back to a meeting and I knew I had a problem, and I knew life wasn't working for me, is when I started to try. And there was nothing more frustrating than wanting to get sober and not getting sober. And I did this circle for 3 years. And if you're in that circle, it's okay. Because I kept coming back, and I was met with love. And I love the person that said they had one day. You know, God bless you. Like, you're going to save all of our lives. We gather together to help others, because if I don't help you, I can't get the freedom that comes. And I had a lot of one days, although I didn't have the guts to stand up and say I had one day. I had to wait till I had 10. But I had that hopelessness, and there were many times I'd get like 60, 90 days and I would use. And for whatever reason, my behavior was so bad. I had acted out so bad on a partner I had who was so devastated, and I saw the pain in somebody else's eyes that the window opened up for me to go to a meeting. And I came in through a different fellowship that, thank God for singleness of purpose, that fellowship started where I heard the voice. And I heard the voice. And 2 weeks later, I want to talk about my journey into recovery. 2 weeks later, I met Ava. I met her at a meeting. She was downtown looking sharp. And I walked over to Ava and I'm like, who are you? And she checked me out and she goes, well, who are you? And she friended me and she said, did you ever listen to speaker tapes? Which I'm going to do a big plug. If you can't get to a meeting, or if you got a little free time, there's a lot of great speaker tapes, and we can get access to them right now. Just Google AA speaker tapes. And for the first time, I started to hear the message of recovery. Not just not drinking, but the message of recovery. Because I knew I wanted to stop using, but I didn't know how to deal with all the pain. And quite frankly, when they pulled the alcohol out of me, I was a shell. I was having panic attacks on a regular basis. I was just full of fear because I hadn't really felt. And I had been using alcohol to solve my alcoholism. But it was killing me. And when I started to hear on those tapes, is there's these things called the steps of recovery. I just want to talk a little bit about my journey into that because it really changed everything. And so the first one was to understand that I am an alcoholic. And it wasn't until I got into the literature, and I remember early on, Ava and Peggy took me to see Joe and Charlie, these two dudes downtown, you know, who were speaking at the time. And they talked us through the book, which I know it's the book, but it actually gave great directions. And it allowed me to see that I suffered. You know, I love in the doctor's opinion, it says, I don't know the difference between what's real and what's false. I was believing the false stuff. And it told me I'm restless, irritable, and discontent until I get the ease and comfort that comes from having the first drink. Which, by the way, now comes from having the first think. I still have to remind myself of that. Because I suffer from thinking. You know, I always think something's wrong today, and I'm reminded of my alcoholism. And then it goes on to say that others can do with impunity. Impunity. I used to think, well, they drink worse than me. Like I have friends that did worse than me and they put it down or they have it occasionally. They did not suffer from the manifestation of the self-hatred I had. So it didn't matter my hangover. My personality changed. I hated myself. And then they told me there's a solution. I love that part. That we can get better. That if we believe in something greater than us, we can get better. I had all these preconceived ideas of how religion had harmed me. My religion didn't love me. And so kind people gave me a faith and said, you can make God anything you want it to be. And sometimes I've reached out to Peggy's actually helped me sometimes because I've had ups and downs in my faith. And I'm at a point in time, I absolutely don't know what my God is, but I absolutely believe in it. How about that? I know in my heart that things shift. I watch people get better. I didn't think they could get better. I've seen things happen I didn't think could happen. And then we got to this point where they talked about the third step. And I love this because it starts to describe exactly what I am. I'm obsessed with myself. I think about myself all the time. All the time. You know, I'm my favorite topic. It's so hard for me to think about, like, even meditation. I did this thing, and on step 11, it's like this thing called Headspace, Take 10, and it should do 10 minutes in 10 days. It took me 21 days to do the 10 minutes for the 10 days, and, you know, to quiet my mind because I first, you know, the picture comes up of me and how you like me, how I like me, right? And how I try to arrange life to work my way. And you know what? My life worked. I forced some things to happen. I had some power, but not enough power to save myself. And when they walk me through, so they describe this path, and they gave me this beautiful third step prayer, which I love, which it says, relieve me of the bondage of self. You know, I offer myself to you. I'm willing to do the rest of the steps, right? Relieve me of the bondage of self, my thinking, my self-obsession, so that my success can bear witness, so I may bear witness to those I would help of thy power, thy love, and thy way of life. You know, the whole reason we stand up here and speak, the whole reason we do service, the whole reason that I say live a full life is that I can bear witness. On the way over here tonight, a guy who I've had an unbelievable life in sobriety. I got to live in Asia for 3.5 years. I got to sponsor a lot of guys in Hong Kong. And one of the guys who I sponsored called me up who used to drink baijiu. I don't know if anybody know baijiu. Baijiu is like grain alcohol from China. And it will get you drunk and make you crazy. And this guy just had a child with his wife, and he's going to have 10 years of sobriety, you know. And I'm going to go to a wedding of another guy in August. You know, the people are recovering. And AA is everywhere. I have to tell you, we did a program in Hong Kong. We did work in the Philippines, Mongolia. A little different. I remember being a big book study, and some guy, we were reading To the Wives, and he said, I have three wives, so this is appropriate. Because in his country, he had three wives. So I don't think Bill would have got sober. A moment on after I do the third step, it says we immediately go to the fourth step, and this is where my life changes. So if you're new, don't worry about it right now. But I can tell you, I had so many resentments. I like what you said, George, I have fears. I'm going to lose what I have, or I'm not going to get what I want. Or here's my resentment. I'll sum it up into one. You don't like me the way I want you to. You don't value me the way I want you to. It could be work. I can cut and paste, right? It affects my self-esteem, my relationship with you, my security, my sex, because I'm less than a man, my pocketbook, because I can't make money. I can't make money, right? When somebody pointed out that all of these things, and also somebody had to really work with me, you know, like I used to say, well, they harmed me. Why do I have a resentment? And actually my sponsee, Cal, who's here, I love it because he was asking me this question, and I said, that happened to you in third grade. You're 40 years old. Right? From third grade to 40 years old, if I'm holding on to something, that's a resentment. Right? That's a resentment. So how do I let go of the fact that I want to hold on to the fact that you victimized me? Whew. I loved being a victim. I was really good at it. You know, I had a PhD in how to be a victim and then how to use that to my favor. But it wasn't helping me at all. And so my eyes started to come open. And when I sat with my sponsor in the fifth step, some kind person, and I told him things I did that sometimes I can share openly now, where I thought I was the most unique individual ever, 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 right? He told me he'd done the same things. I got relief. I don't have to, I can look the world in the eyes, the promise we get. You know? And then in 6 and 7, I start to understand, what are the things, what are the real things that are continuous? You know, I become ready. I become willing to know they're happening. I can see when I'm people pleasing. I had no boundaries. You know, I just thought, I thought it was better to say yes to you and not show up. I thought that worked well. And I did that into sobriety, right? So the 6 is being aware that it's happening, right? Don't date more than one person if you're saying you're only dating one person. You know, don't, you know, realize when it seems like that money is the company's money, you can have it. Don't do it. In step 7, I act the opposite. I show up for stuff. You know, we say act as if. I show up for stuff. 8 and 9, I get to have different relationships with people, all those people that harmed me, all those people I harmed that had real estate in my head. When I came in here, there were like a few people that I was obsessed, you know, because they were in my head, especially my ex. And I learned what forgiveness is. And I learned I could go and meet with them and be released. You know, I didn't get it. I didn't get like, oh, God, I have to apologize and I have to say this. And then I have to ask him what else. And then he gives me an answer. But you know what happened? I quit thinking about him when it was done. I got untethered. I got untethered. And when that happened, I rewrote my past. The 9-step promises. If you don't know what they are, go read them. I rewrote the past. My past got better. It wasn't so bad. The weight came off. In 10, it told me how to do those on a daily basis. In 11, I get a plug into a power greater than myself because I'm so full of things that are outside of me. I'm able to look at other stuff, and it gives us great direction to go do all these things, meditation or read other books on the outside or, you know, I tried Eckhart Tolle and all these things that I couldn't touch. I read a lot of self-help because I was trying to get self-help. You know, and finally, it tells us to go share the message, you know, practice these principles and all our, it says we had a spiritual awakening because of the steps. I took the steps, I changed. I didn't expect to change, I changed. I changed. And I'm able to carry the message to have this life. You know, I still have crazy stuff. I like this one story I'll just give you that happened to me recently at work. And this is the steps in action. I'm in the executive, meeting of my company. The fact I'm invited to the executive meeting is unbelievable, that I participate and have a lead role in it. And the head of HR is sitting next to me and they're talking and this guy's talking and I'm loud. Surprise. And I talked over this guy and she grabbed my arm and she goes, "Why don't you just let him talk?" And I'm like, "I'm going to cut you." You know, in my head, I'm going to cut her open, right? And then I pause for a minute. We pause, you know, and I let stuff come in. And then I think, well, yeah, maybe I'm a little loud, right? Maybe. Now I'm not going to talk the rest of the meeting. Silent scorn. I am not going to contribute to anything else they say. I'm going to show them, harm them. That was a good one. I would harm myself to harm you. That does not work well. If that's your plan, it doesn't work well. I used to say, I'll go drink to get back at you. It never worked once. Never worked once. And then by 2 minutes later, it had settled in. I realized, I think maybe I have to give an amends. Like, I think I have to talk. And then I came back into the meeting, and I was able to participate. That happened within 2 minutes. That is an act of God and a result of the 12 steps of AA. And I can live my life like that. And I have tons of stories. Like if I don't get my seat on the plane or service people, you know, sometimes the best I can do is just not spit on them or yell at them. And the funny thing is in early recovery, I would do things like I would do a full day's work and not cheat on my expense account. And I expected the company to like write me a letter of thanks. You know, thank you for being a normal, regular employee. I can't express the gratitude and the humor and the love. And I have a life beyond my wildest dreams. You know, I'm married 5 years in a relationship for almost 10 years with somebody who I didn't even think was possible in my life. Didn't come easy. My first 5 years of sobriety were not easy. I had a lot of other issues. I needed to get outside help. I had relationship stuff, sex stuff. And so it's a process. I stay in the middle because that's what I was taught to do. I sponsor. When I first got to Hong Kong, I didn't sponsor people the first year because I was kind of moving around. I called my sponsor back in the U.S. I said, I'm busy. He says, raise your hand. Sponsor whoever asks you. You know what? For 1 year, I had a bit of a gap, and that changed everything. When I'm in the middle, when I'm helping, whether they want it or not, it helps me. I'm so grateful, guys, that I got to be the 30-minute speaker at AG. Life is good. Thank you.